Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Welcome to Proper Mental episode 172, and my guest this week is Bill Ryder-Jones, who is a singer-songwriter, a musician, a music producer, and a composer. And Bill was one of the co-founders of The Coral, which they started at school when they were just 13, and he played lead guitar on the first five albums, eventually leaving in 2008. And it was around then that Bill started to experience depression and agoraphobia and having panic attacks before he went on stage, and that would eventually lead him to leave The Coral at the height of their success. At that time, it wasn't made public that Bill's mental health issues were a result of witnessing the death of his brother in a freak accident while they were on a family holiday as children. And following the breakdown that led to him leaving the band, Bill started to work on his solo career, and to date has released five solo albums under his own name, and he's collaborated with people like the Arctic Monkeys and Graham Coxon and Paloma Faith, and he's produced records for Mick Head and the Red Elastic Band and Saint Saviour and many others, working out of his own studio, Yawn Studios, which is based in West Kirby on the Wirral. And his latest record, Yucky Da, was released in January to a fanfare of praise and glowing reviews, and it's already a contender for Album of the Year. And in this episode, I chat to Bill about the album, about the songs, and about the upcoming tour. And we chat about Bill's experiences with agoraphobia and how it affects him day to day and in relationships. And we chat about touring and drinking and getting older and making music. We also chat about panic attacks and dealing with fear and being alone, and how sometimes choosing an unhealthy coping strategy is actually choosing the lesser of many possible evils. And I just love chatting to Bill. He is such a lovely man. He's kind of a bucket list guest for me. I'm a big fan of his music. I'm a big fan of everything that he's done. But his new record in particular is stunning. And I think I've listened to it every day at least once since it came out. So to get the opportunity to chat to him all about it, I suppose was a podcasting highlight, really, both professionally and personally. And the fact that he's just such a lovely guy and we got on so well, it just kind of makes this a really lovely episode, and on a personal level, a really special one. And it was really fun too. You know, we made each other laugh a lot, which was a really nice thing considering the sort of the depth of some of the things that we were talking about. So there's a lot of sadness in this episode, and there's a lot of fun as well, and that's kind of how it should be, I think. And just a huge thank you to Bill for coming on, and a huge thank you to Aoife from Domino for putting the conversation together. So Yucky Da is out now, and Bill's about to go off on tour as well. He's touring all over the UK, and then he's off to Europe. I've put a link in the episode notes to his website, and that's where you can find all the dates. I've seen Bill live. I've seen him a couple of times. I usually go and watch him in Liverpool, and he's always brilliant. He's got a wonderful band. Go and see him if you haven't before. Go and get the record. It's wonderful. If you would like to watch me and Bill have a good old natter, you can do so, because the video recording is up on the Proper Mental Patreon page. It's £3 a month to sign up. That's where all the videos go. They don't go anywhere else, and I put them up as soon as I record them. So there's normally a bunch of stuff up there that's not available anywhere else, and the audio won't be coming out for weeks or even months. And you can also submit questions to upcoming guests as well. So if there's anyone coming up on the show and you think, oh, I'd be interested to know that about them, you can ask the question on the Patreon and I'll get it asked on the podcast. And your £3, it just keeps the show independent, sponsor-free, advert-free, and it just allows me to just keep doing it and keep having wonderful conversations. There's a link in the episode notes, and your support is very much appreciated. If you've come here because you're a music fan and you love listening to musicians on podcasts, particularly talking about their mental health, you're in the right place, because I've done bloody loads of them. It's well worth a scroll through the back catalogue. I've spoke to people like Frank Turner, Tom and Katie from The Lottery Winners, Danny McNamara from Embrace, Adam Nutter from The Music, Bill McCarthy from We Are Augustines, Mark Richardson from Skunk Anansie, Jess Greenfield from Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, and probably a whole host of others that I can't remember off the top of my head. But I'm a massive music geek, so I do tend to lean quite heavily towards music-related episodes, I suppose. So go and have a look in the back catalogue, have a listen. And if you like what you hear, take 2 minutes to leave a review on Spotify or iTunes. That'd be much appreciated. And this is episode 172 of the Proper Mental Podcast with Bill Ryder-Jones. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy. I like that about it. I don't know. I like the kind of, you know, I have no right to have spoke to some of the people that I've spoken to, right? But I love the, it's kind of like a DIY punk rock thing almost. You can just fucking buy a microphone and DM people and see what you can make happen. Yeah. And it's something that.
It's lovely. It's a wonderful thing. It's like one of the few, you can do it completely yourself. And if you're good at it, it takes off. It's great, man. It's a wonderful thing.
Man. Cool. I'll intro this episode, mate. We can just dive straight in. Here we are with another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast. And my guest this week is Bill Ryder-Jones. How are you, mate?
I'm great, thank you. Yeah. Or should I say that? Yeah.
Yeah, whatever's true. Say whatever's true.
Oh, well, I'm hungover and it's my day off.
Oh, mate. There you go.
I'm still in pajamas and I had leftover curry for breakfast, so it's I'm living my early 20s again. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like quite a nice day to me, to be honest. But
been lovely. Yeah. I've got a wildlife telly show on the telly. It's nice. And my manager dropped around some cigarettes for me, so it's just
happy day.
Life for Riley,
yeah. And it's St. David's Day today as well, mate. There you go. I thought that was a handy place to start. What with the album having a Welsh name, and I'm Welsh myself as well, so it's of interest to me. That thing there, yeah.
This old thing.
That old thing. I've got one of those.
That's
pretty good. But I've been living in this record since it came out. It's a wonderful collection of songs, and it seems like it's been so well received. People seem to really like it. How's that been, mate? Putting it out and getting the response.
I'm more comfortable with it now. I had one of those horrible things that often does happen when, you know, obviously I've spent years and I've given a lot to this record. I'm super proud of it. But of course, somewhere in you think when it comes out, you're magically going to be happy. And inevitably, the day it came out, I just wasn't feeling it. Just didn't, you know, and for a week or two afterwards, I was sort of everyone around me, and this is just normal life, but, you know, my manager and the label, so much great press, and people are saying lovely things, and everyone's excited. And you get this guilt, because I just thought I'd be happy. I just thought this would make me happy. And it didn't, so I battled that for a bit. But now, bit of time's passed and sort of look back and now I'm much more comfortable and I'm very proud and it is meaning a lot to me, the things that people are saying. I feel like people are saying the things, how to word this, people are pointing out things that I really care about on the record, like the attention to detail and like you saying that phrase, you know, I've lived in this record, that's exactly what it's for. Whereas I think, you know, in the past, you know, it's always the phrases that we always used were sort of like good, you know, nice songwriting, intimate and honest. And it's still all that, but people are talking about the sounds and the orchestrations and the things that I spent the most time on. So, you know, that's a nice feedback loop, you know, that sort of reward thing. So, yeah, no, short answer is I'm very happy about the record.
Oh, mate. Well, that's good. I suppose if, you know, you've been spending all that time with it, putting all that stuff together, and then there has to come a point when it comes out, right? Or you just, otherwise you just, you know, you Axl Rose it, right? But but it must be such a strange thing. And I've spoke to some people who are like, as soon as it's out, they're like, right, done, on to the next. And I've spoke to people who say, you know, oh, I wish I had another month to tinker with it, you know? But I suppose there has to come a time when it comes out, right?
Well, it's interesting. Like, I had that. I mean, the record was finished like a year ago, but it was mixed in February, but I wasn't ready to let it go at all. I really wasn't. And as a result, sort of wrote two other songs and demanded that they go on it because just wasn't ready to let it go at all. It wasn't a case of, I thought that it desperately needed tweaks or two more songs, but yeah, I just couldn't. I was like, oh no, it's not that. No, I'm not ready. So then obviously I got another month to work on it, and we got them it, and then you're sitting on it for the best part of a year, sort of. And that's a nice place to be, because it's, you know, there's no dis you know, you can't be disappointed. You just, again, you're just living with a record. I knew that it was a good record, you know. I knew I was proud of it. I knew people would like it. Well, I thought, you know, I was very confident about that. So it was nice just to sort of enjoy that year, knowing that the start of 2023 was going to be positive. 2024, fucking hell, was going to be positive, you know. Yeah, so
Yeah.
that's nice, you know. It's like sort of like when you book your holiday in January for the summer. So it's something to, you know, look forward to, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I suppose it doesn't matter what it is, right? If something takes up a big part of our life and then it's not anymore, then there's a gap, right? And that can make us feel odd. And it doesn't really matter what
Totally.
it is, right? You know,
Oh,
so.
absolutely, man. There's you just it's just everything from how much mental space it takes up to, I mean, quite literally, well, what else do I do with all this time now? You know, that's what. And then you also factor in the fact that something changes when it is a record. It's no longer your thing. It was my thing, you know. It was something that I had. It was just mine, and now the world has it, you know, and they're saying lovely things about it, but I'm sort of resentful that they're enjoying it. No, you know, it's like I was saying it the other day, like I'm huge Cookies, I Got It Monkey fan, and because they're not huge, they it feels like they're mine. Like out of all in the Coral, I was the big Gorky's fan, and then I met Cliff, who plays with Griff, and he was like, oh, I love Gorky's, they're my favorite band in the world, and I instantly didn't like him because of that, you know what I mean? And
Yeah.
it's a bit, and I love Cliff, by the way, I do know, but at the first met him, I was like, fuck, do you think you are that, talking about this band, and you're American, fucker. But yeah, there's a certain amount of that where you're sort of like precious about this baby, and then it's, you know, but you know, it's a very, very complicated relationship with this record in particular. It's been a real, more so than any record I've ever done, has been, yeah, just like you just lived it and absolutely lived, consumed me, and lived it for the best part of 2.5 years, you know. So it's a bit like yeah, I don't know, it's somewhere between losing someone, a breakup, and sending a kid off to school. It's somewhere in the middle of that. Not that
Yeah.
I've got kids. Let me just get me cigarettes. Sorry.
Yeah, no worries, man. No worries at all.
I can still hear you.
Right. I was going to ask about the tour, Bill. You know, that's coming up over the next few weeks, and you're off to Europe as well. And I was wondering how I know that agoraphobia is something that you've experienced in the past, and how you filter that in with a tour on the horizon.
Well, to be honest, the agoraphobia, which is still very real in my life, isn't too bad on tour, because I need to get a lighter. Excuse me.
No
Sorry,
worries.
mate. With the my agoraphobia, it's, yeah, in tour world, it's less of a problem, because you're in a van, you have a tour manager who takes care of things, and you're just driven from one place to another. It's if it wasn't for the actual gigs and the anxiety that they, I don't just mean like the possible panic attacks, but the generalized anxiety of knowing you've got to be on stage later. If it wasn't for that, it'd be quite a relaxing time, really. Yeah, most of my problems are more about going outside into the big world on my own. So if you're in a van full of your friends, it's largely okay, you know. And
Yeah.
unfortunately, my, you know, after 30 years, 15 years of me telling people how hard it is to live with this condition. They're all aware now, so there's no one of the biggest problems with this stuff is people, like hurts me quite a lot when I start seeing someone, I start dating someone, and they want to go for walks, and should we just go to the pictures? And I have to sort of explain, like, yeah, we can, but like, so I need an escape route. I need da, 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 and so on tour, my tour manager, my band, they're all absolute loves and are very aware about my issues. So thank God, thank God that we're there, we're finally there,
Yeah, I mean that's just such a beautiful thing, isn't it? Being able to like talk openly about this stuff and then have the people around us help us to put things in place to navigate
Absolutely.
and get shit done. I just read a really good book about agoraphobia. It was by an author called Graham Caveney. I don't know if you've heard of him. I'm trying to get him on the show at the moment, but he wrote a memoir about his experience of agoraphobia, and he said that the common misconception, that as he sees it, is people think it's a fear of going out, but for him, it's a fear of something terrible happening while he's out. And I was
Right,
just
okay.
wondering if that kind of sort of made any sense to you, if that kind of rang any bells with you.
Well, so that's just his,
Yeah, sure.
to quote the Big Lebowski. Hey man, that's just like, your opinion, man. With me, I have no irrational fear that anything's bad's going to happen to me other than it being a panic attack and me being left on my own with no one to help. That's my, the more you speak to people who suffer with these things, they're all very, they share similarities, but in my instance, it's quite sort of understood that I was left on my own when I was a child during a very traumatic night. After all the therapy and stuff, we sort of, that's what you do. You pinpoint where you think the fear is. And for me, it's become secondary. It's a sort of secondary anxiety now, where the it's really unfortunate, actually, because when was it, 2004, I had my breakdown. And back then, what I was being told was, well, you need to keep your mind active and avoid the negative thoughts. So I did that for 10 years, crosswords, and then all of a sudden it's, oh no, sorry, this actually probably not the best thing to do. Now we advise that you have the panic attack, let the adrenaline flood your body and let it leave so that your brain can realize that there was no threat. But I'd spent 10 years proving my brain right, saying there's a threat, So, and now it's like unlearning, and I haven't even begun to unlearn. I believe it can happen, CBT, EMDR in particular. But yeah, but my, but no, my issue is largely, like, I'd say it's monophobia more than agoraphobia, which is just fear of being alone. But it's specifically one thing that I found really interesting is if I am outside and it happens, I'd look, as an adult, I want, that's the first thing I look for. I'm 40 years old, but for some reason I'm a child in that moment, so yeah, for me, there is no, it's not like, I was having to explain it to my father years ago. I was like, I'm in the park, I'm having a panic attack. It's like, Bill, there's no reason to have a panic attack. Nothing's going to happen to you in a park in West Kirby. No, Dad, I know. The thing I'm scared of happening is happening. I'm having the attack. There's no threat. There's no lion. There's no one with a gun to it. And he's like, oh, you don't, he doesn't really have an answer for that. Because for him, fear is based on the possibility of something happening. Whereas for me, it's not being able to regulate the my frazzled fucking nervous system, it's that simple, really, but I'd be interested in reading that book, though, that sends a
Yeah,
reminder.
will do. Yeah, it's no, it's a really Really good read. Yeah, really good read. It's interesting what you said there about the change in like in the approach to dealing with this stuff. Because I've had a lot of problems with anxiety over the years, Bill. So I kind of like I've got like one foot in that space. And something that I always say is that like knowing something and feeling something are two different fucking things, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you can know that you are safe and not feel like it, and it makes no fucking difference what you know when you're feeling it, right?
Absolutely. And well, here's the thing. The brain, when you have a panic attack, your brain is treating you in the same way it would treat you if there was a car speeding at you. I mean, it is flooding your body full of adrenaline so you can be slightly quicker and escape whatever the threat is. It comes from the Serengeti. Animals do it, they're flooded with this wonder drug that can just give you a little bit more. And the brain doesn't care if it's a lion or a car or just the existential dread of being on the planet. And that's one thing that I wish people knew more is just how tiring it is. I've let this thing take me in all kinds of directions over the last 20 years. Drugs, drink, sex, promiscuity, sort of danger, self-harm, like anything to control, to gain some control of my emotional system. And one thing people you have, if I went out today, right? I'm quite hungover today. I went out with James Skelly last night and we had a nice catch up and I had a few too many whiskeys. Now, I know for a fact if I've had too many drinks, then the next day I go out is going to be a lot harder. I'm aware of that. So if I did that today and I went out and it happened and and then I spoke to someone and it's like, oh, I had a panic attack. And they say, oh, how are you now? And I say, well, I'm fine now. But what I should say is, you know what? I'm fucking exhausted. My body's just been through a huge traumatic thing. I feel embarrassed, I'm sad and I'm fucking exhausted. And when this happens sort of three or four times a week, the knock-on effect is, it's, and I've sort of only recently really given myself any credit for this because I, like most people, when you feel there's something intrinsically wrong with you, I'm so used to being upset by, a wave of sadness can just crash over me if I'm with a friend and they say, oh, what did you do the weekend? Oh, we took the kids in the car and we walked up Movember. Yeah. And I'll straight away my gut will just go, fuck, I can't do that. I just can't drive, can't have kids largely because of these problems. And I certainly can't walk up a fucking mountain. And you get so used to feeling that you can't do things that everyone else can do that are just taken for granted. And it's exhausting. It's exhausting smiling through that stuff constantly, and I've always given myself a hard time, but just now trying to sort of allow myself to sleep as much as I need. And actually, if I can't tidy the flat, I just can't fucking tidy the flat and not think, oh, you're 40, you haven't got this, you haven't got this. And it's, yeah, and that's just something that's been on my mind. I think that was probably a little bit of a ramble there, but it's true. And added to that as well, I've been so hard on myself this year in particular with my drinking. For obvious reasons, I know I'm more anxious if I'm hungover, but I find life really fucking hard, and I drink quite a lot. And that's not the best way to cope. But right now, that's what's happening. And holding your hands up and going, that's what's happening is, like you say, it's understanding something leads to accepting it. And once you've accepted it, then it's easier to make the change. But yeah, absolutely agree. There's a huge difference between knowing something and feeling it. Yeah, and knowing it exists and knowing it, you know. So,
Yeah, I mean, you really kind of like it's finding that compassion for yourself, isn't it? And
I
like,
just think, well,
it really is, isn't it? Yeah, my therapist said to me once that like you can only if someone gives you a compliment, it only has any sort of effect at all if you believe it to be true. So
yeah,
people can
right.
say loads of nice things to you, but if you don't believe them, it doesn't fucking matter. And that's why self-compassion is so hard, because everyone says, "Oh, be kind to yourself," and it's like, "Well, I don't really like myself, so
No,
how am I supposed to be kind?" You know, and that's a hard thing to do, isn't
exactly.
it? To learn how to say, "Do you know what? Like, what happened this morning? What you've been through? Whatever it is, like, that's really shit." And you know, if anything, you fucking deserve a nap and a bit wildlife TV. But we don't do that, do we? We go the other way
No.
of the shame and the guilt.
So absolutely. I find it well, yeah, and that's so true. I also think that when I speak to my friends who are struggling, I know that I'm saying the right things because that's what you do. You tell them these, you know, you gotta be kind, you gotta stop beating yourself up, you've got to do, and you give this information away. Have it, but someone says it to me, it just fucking what it goes somewhere else, you know. But for someone else, you're absolutely right, and you believe it, you're telling them the truth. But when they give it back to you, it's that means fuck all because I don't feel it. It's a very strange thing. Yeah, and I don't know the answer because that's the last interview I did. The guy who also sort of, you know, a lot of interviews I do have a mental health part to them, you know, involved in. And he was very much of the sort of, but Bill, you need to find. I was telling him that story about how I wasn't happy the day the album came out and I felt really guilty about it. And he's like, well, you know, trying to tell me, and he's saying the right thing, you know, that's the external validation doesn't mean anything unless you have it. And I was like, I know. And he said, and you need to get it. I was like, oh, I know. Give it to me. Like, you know, where then? You know, I can't, and it's so true. Like, I'm struggling with my weight at the moment. I've always struggled with my weight. You know, when you look back at photos of you and you're really thin, and I remember thinking at the time, I hate that photo because I look really big. And I'm having that at the minute, and I've had two sort of brief relationships end of last year and this year, two different people. And, you know, I've been talking about it, and they're saying to me, you know, Bill, this is dysmorphia. You are fine. You know what I mean? You're really overthinking. And these people that I'm, you know, was intimate with, you know what I mean? But I just don't believe it. I would much rather, for some reason, my brain goes, they're just saying that because they know I'm worried about it. Of course, they couldn't go, well, you could stand to lose a few. Do you know what I mean? Like things, I sometimes worry that it's just like, you know, I have ADHD, and I just worry that sometimes I'm obsessive rumination. So I just wonder, sometimes my brain doesn't like the quiet, and I create these things to worry about, or these albums to make to occupy me from that silence. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, very much so. It's I always think like anxiety is such a like a sneaky little bastard, and I kind of find once I kind of get a bit better at one area of it. So for a long time, social anxiety was my thing, right? So I you know, if you invited me out for a coffee, I'd be like, nah, I can't sit there and talk to someone. You know, like, they'd be weird. I'm gonna have to talk about myself, and I'm fucking they, you know, they'll think I'm weird, all this sort of stuff. And I kind of got a handle on that. And then it just moves into something else. You know, so like you're saying about your weight, that's where I'm at the moment. I'm kind of like, you're very much so. I'm like, yeah, I mean, I could go and, you know, if someone asked me out for a coffee, then I would go for a coffee, and I'd probably have two slices of cake because I'm a fat bastard. You know, like it just kind of moves into a different area of my brain. And
Yeah,
it's like it's coming from a different
so true.
direction.
So
Doesn't
true.
matter,
Like
doesn't matter.
tectonic plates, aren't they?
Yeah.
Just like the crust is just always, yeah. I know it's really funny you say that. Like, it's
Like
so true.
a sniper waiting, you know, waiting
Yeah.
to
Oh, can too right, man. Yeah. Like, I had it the other day. I was like, Liam, my best friend, he's wearing these nice pair of cords. You know, he bought some new cords. And I was like, oh, I haven't had cords in years. I've got a nice pair of shoes that look nice with cords. I'm going on tour. Buy myself some cords. Sat down on the computer to buy the cords. I was like, fuck, what size am I? And I was like, oh, fucking hell. I'm gonna have to go and get the fucking tape measure now. Do you know what I mean? And I literally had to be like, oh, this is gonna be fucking. I was like, 36. You fucking cunt. So even buying a nice pair of trousers, that all I wanted was a nice, and for some reason they came, and I'm like, because I know that I'm a 36 and they fit me, I can't stop looking at myself in the mirror going, am I mad? Am I fucking mad? Never fucking stopped, does it? You know?
It doesn't. I suppose like maybe if you just keep, I don't know. Maybe it's like accept the lesser of loads of evils, right? So it's like, right, okay, well, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm certainly not doing that anymore. So
Yeah.
maybe I'll just be the fat guy and not be happy about that, you know, just like
It's true.
accept.
It's so true, you know, yeah, it's like, well, I'm probably, you know, I'm probably putting on weight because I don't take drugs anymore. So that's
Yeah.
good. But
Exactly.
at least when I was taking drugs, I looked fucking great. And I'm a vain. And that's the other thing that I'm like, 40. When you hit 40 and you see 40, it feels old. It sounds old to me. You know, obviously people are going, 40 is not old. You know, my dad's 68 and Bill, 40 is nothing, you know. And of course, I thought the same when I was 30. But now I look back at 30 and think, when I meet someone who's 30, I'm like, little fucking shit. You're just out of school. You know what I mean?
Yeah, completely. Yeah, so we're the same age bracket, right? I'm
Yeah.
42. So yeah, I get it. I always think like there's a youngness to 30 that you don't appreciate when you're in it. And we all know someone who's like, you know, 50, 60, particularly musicians are cool as fuck. And you think, oh, I wouldn't mind being like them when I'm 60, you know, but like this 40 is just this like middle ground, this
Yeah,
wasteland, isn't
no,
it?
yeah, totally. It's in between. It's like, fortunately for men, if you're lucky with genetics, you do get what me and my friends refer to as the Clooney era, where you get another go when you're about 50. If you look after yourself, you get another chance to be like hot, don't you? But 40 is like fucking letting go of like being able to eat curry every night and pot noodles and bevy and smoke weed and feel fine. Well, feel fine, but look fine. Letting go of that and knowing that Clooney feels possible if you start taking care of yourself now. It's like you gotta get, if you want that, you gotta do it now. And ultimately, I have no time for now.
Yes.
I'm either fucking obsessed with something that happened to me when I was 7, or desperately looking forward to something that's coming in a year or whatever, you know, or this fictional partner that I might meet who's going to change my life, or you know what I mean, or this wonder drug that's going to cure my fucking issues, you know. Like for me, psychedelic assisted therapy has been sort of the thing that I've been banking on fixing me for, you know, since it started to come. I've been reading all about it. I'm very interested in trying it because, yeah, 20 years of CBT, talk therapy, EMDR, hypnotherapy, acupuncture, you know, everything. And I'm still trapped in this little boy who saw a terrible thing. It's just like, fucking hell. Fucking hell. Sometimes I feel quite, in the past, I felt quite guilty about talking about my mental health problems so much, but it occurred to me that it's one of the reasons I make music is to say to people, look at me, like fucking see me, you know what I mean, like, and tell me I'm good. And I think probably if I acknowledge that I do that with music, then I acknowledge it's exactly the same thing. It's very important to me to be like, it's fucking, you know, it's hard. Life's fucking really hard. And I say that knowing full well that I'm middle class white and grew up in a really nice area, of loving parents and great friendship group, great support network. So I know I'm lucky in that way, but it does not change that one simple fact that I don't really like myself. You know, for the majority of the time, I don't really like myself. And I think, and it's not just myself, it's my place in the world and what the world is. It's, you know, it's my life, I guess, is what I'm saying. I don't really love my life. I love making music. But that has just become my whole life. You know, it's, and I have nothing else. And nothing, you know, I've nothing else. And that's, it's good and bad, isn't it? Because obviously, you know, the record's great because I'm obsessed about it and I care about it a lot more than some of the musicians that I've encountered, you know, or seen, or you know, when I hear people do interviews, you know, or I hear their music, and I think there's no way that saved your life, you know, whoever's made the music. There's no way this is keeping you from dropping down that pit. And not, you know, not all music has to be that, and that's fair, and you know, I shouldn't be judgmental, but yeah, that's the trade-off, is that, like, you know, it is my source of my sense of self and my reward system. And sometimes you just think, like, oh, I wish I could add the money to get into model railways or something all the time, you know.
I mean, you know, with that in mind, what you were just saying, how's it, what's it like? You know, you've always talked openly about mental health stuff, and you know, you write about it and you sing about it, but you've got a day of interviews today, and everyone's going to ask you at some point, you know. I mean, I'm kind of like, I'm putting myself out there because this is a mental health podcast. I'm definitely going to fucking ask you, but you're going to get asked at some point by everyone, and you know, that's not your job. Your job is to play guitar, and do you know what I mean? Like, what's that like for you? You know, you're going to get asked, right?
And look, I couldn't bemoan that because I started this thing, you know. And it's interesting, and those who can talk about it and can articulate it and can give experience and should, I think. You don't have to if it's, I know people who go through awful things and aren't comfortable talking about them. But I am, and I'll be honest with you, I was worried on this record that everything was all going to be all about that. But I found it really quite cathartic because it's a whole new bunch of people that I can tell how bad things have been, you know. And I think when you, I don't like telling my parents anymore. They've had it for 20 years. My friends, you don't want to see my friends, you know. I'll catch up with the boys from school. I really want to just go on about that again, you know, talk about, so I think it sort of fills a need a little bit that I have to be heard in that way. And that's the completely selfish side of it. The other side of it, of course, is the amount of messages I get from people when I do talk about things. Is you know, is a positive. I think if I'd have heard, obviously, like I mentioned now, my coping mechanisms are largely drink based, and that's not good advice, you know. So I could never claim, I just never say anyone should really listen to me for anything other than an honest take on what it's like and what can happen and what I'm going through. So no, I it's yeah, it's fine. You know, being asked about Paloma Faith and Arctic Monkeys and the Coral gets a bit boring. When you've got a record out. But mental health stuff, I mean, it's been such a part of my life, and I wasn't able to talk about it for so long. You know, it's just not 10 years, 15, 20 years of just not being able to talk. did me no favors whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean that relatability is so like when you hear someone else that you know the people that whose music we listen to or whose books we read or whatever, and you hear someone else say something that I don't know. Maybe if you feel like you so when I was in a position where I could talk about it because I didn't have the vocabulary and I didn't know what the fuck was happening to me. I just thought it was kind of mad. And then you hear someone else talking and you think, fucking hell, man, that sounds not all of that sounds a bit of me, but some of it does. And maybe I could pinch that phrase or those words, and then maybe I can start to articulate it. So, you know, like it's a powerful thing. How did you arrive at the point where you could start to talk about it after not talking for all those years?
Well, it was one of those. I put it down. I think, listen, you know when like your nan is getting old, and it's just going a bit batty, and they're just saying whatever the fuck they want. I just think that happened to me when I was about 30 or maybe 25. I think I just had enough of. It was a bit of a light bulb moment. I think I was, I was doing things to get the attention of people to say, "Look at me," hoping that they would look at me and someone would go, "Bill, what's going on?" And they didn't. And my ways of getting their attention at the time, to do with drugs and promiscuity and self-harm, which would be the main way of sort of, showing your pain to someone. And I just it just wasn't working. It just and I just I think a friend of mine asked me to do an interview for this magazine he was doing, and he knew my personal story, one that I at this point wasn't really talking about. He knew about the drugs and he knew about the deaths and those things. And he asked me about it, and because he was a friend, I felt quite comfortable, and he seemed to be asking from a genuine place. I answered, and then that interview sort of did the rounds a little bit, and then it just seemed that from then on, people were asking me more and more, and I just went with it. It felt good, and I just realized that yeah, most of my, from being a young boy to mid-20s, a lot of my problems were coming from the fact that I wasn't telling people how I was feeling and expecting them to know. Of course, grew up in the north, lovely parents, but in the 90s there was not a lot of talking. No, there was no, it just was, and it's still a bit like that, to be honest with you. But certainly we weren't a family that, dad came home from work and we all sat at the table and chatted about the day. It wasn't that at all, man. I mean, even when I was in the Coral, like touring, and get a phone call off my mum, "Where are you? Your nan's coming over." I'd be like, "Oh, I'm in Japan." We just had completely different lives, "All right, okay, sound well, have fun. See you when you get back." There wasn't a great deal of communication. I've got no siblings either. I mean, you just me, my mum, and my dad, we all just lived very separate lives after Daniel died. I think that's it. It comes from that.
Yeah, I really relate to what you were saying then about asking for help without asking for help. You know, like my behavior was horrendous, and I to me I was like, why is no one stepping in? Can't they see I'm really fucking playing up here? And of course they weren't going to. They just thought I was being a dick.
You just
And then
thought
it,
you were dead. Yeah, I know.
yeah, and like it's and now you think, oh, fucking hell, man, all I had to do is just put my hand up and say, look, there's something really shit's happening. I don't know what it is, but it's the hardest thing to do. But we show it for our behavior, right? We scream for
Well,
help.
and sadly, if you've learned that if your message, if your thing is, "I'm gonna act up so someone pays attention," and that, and you think that that's the way to do it, when you don't get that attention, you're even less likely to put your hand up, because in your opinion, or from your experience, you've already been ignored by everyone. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, I've got to say, in my case, I think it's quite mad that I had to go to those lengths for people to, you know, I'm a textbook child of trauma. Do you know, like it textbook like behavior, like where I've ended up there. You know, it's, you know, I should be a textbook. So you know, and so and sadly for a lot of people do put their hands up and no one listens as well. You know, you've gotta the people you're around, obviously you can isolate yourself from good people by acting out. So they're the only people you're left with, the fucking drug addicts and musicians who are sort of living for the moment and, you know, are not happy to get on it with you and, you know, and, you know, the only time you feel bad is on the come down. You know, that's a fucking shit. That's a terrible way to perceive the world and friends and love and honesty of who you are. You know, we end up in some very odd corners of the world doing that, don't we?
Me, I can well imagine. Like drinkers, like enable each other. Yeah, I'm sober now, Bill. I used to be a drinker, and I would find the people that allowed me to behave exactly as I wanted to, right? That's kind of that's what we do. And I suppose in the music industry, you can hide in plain sight. You can be like you completely bonkers, and it's
Not
just
even the
rock and
music
roll, right?
industry. It's not even the music industry. I'll be honest with you. It's the town. You can do it anywhere. You do not need that excuse, man. It's weird. Like there's more drugs in my local pub, snorted by kids who go who play rugby, 20-year-olds who play rugby than I've ever fucking seen on tour. You know what I mean? Like
Yeah.
you can find it anything anywhere. The thing with a drink, I've known for a while that sobriety is probably something that I'm gonna have to really do. I've tried last year, started going to meetings, and the pressure I put on myself was just making me very ill. Like my inability to do it. I'd just about go to the meetings, but not being able to say no, I was just kicking myself too much, drinking more. I don't know. It's something that's on my mind. But getting back to the thing with drink and the thing with pubs and drinking culture is I know I can go to my local and there'll be someone already who's already been there for 2 hours drinking, and I can leave before they leave, so I'm not the worst. Do you know what I'm saying? And that for some reason makes me go, well, you know what? At least I know Joe will be there. You know, or like, you know, I'm there. I'm in my local pretty much every night, you know? And it's the same group of people largely, do you know what I mean? But so, even in my head, there's a few people in there who are worse than me. Do you know what I mean? So for some reason, that means I don't have to do jack shit about it, which is complete bullshit, and I do. But it's really strange. Like I was only talking to my friend about this the other day. Like this, I know a few people on Twitter who are sober, and it's their life. You know, like, and that's great. You know, whatever works, but there's a huge difference between getting sober because you used to go out and drink fucking 12 pints and kick people's fucking heads in, and what I do, which is drink every day, come home and sob and write music. This is sort of different menace to society. So, you know, but again, this might just be me sort of making excuses because I know I'm not ready to stop.
I kind of know what you mean though, because like there is this narrative, particularly online, where because sobriety is like it's popular now, right? And it like I quit drinking, now my life's amazing, and I've got loads of money, and I've got all these mates, and all we do is loads of sober stuff, and like that. I always say whenever I talk about it, that weren't my experience, right? That weren't my experience. And do you know what? When I was drinking, I never tried to kill myself once. All that shit started when I stopped, right? Like it's so like it's not it. It's all our individual experience,
It is, and also you can't really take fucking anything online as gold, can you? You
Not
know,
at all. Not at all.
purpose for everything. Like I in the most base level, there isn't a single photograph of me that goes on my Instagram where I look like I actually look. You know, it's all a trickery, and I do not, you know, like the photos of me from band practice that someone's taken where my guts out or my chin, or I'm like this. It's not, doesn't exist, mate. It's not going on. Doesn't happen. So yeah, so you've got to be sort of suspicious of, yeah, that narrative of, you know, and I also really resent this. It's really interesting. Like I've had this with a few people, right? I know my drinking can be challenging for partners, because I get emotional, you know, and I'm an emotional drunk, and I forget, which is I'm not a blackout drunk. I don't get blackout drunk, but if I've had a few whiskeys, I pretty much guarantee I can't remember. You know, I can remember how I got home, but if I've had a long conversation with someone, happens countless times. Do you remember what we talked about last night? And I'm like, no, but I know I meant it. I know I wasn't lying. You know what I mean? I know whatever I was saying, I mean, because I'm not a bullshitter, but I just can't remember. I'm sorry. And that hurts people a lot. And where was it? Where did I get onto that? Sorry, I've lost my train of thought there. That's a worry, isn't it? Yeah, it can be. I know it can be a problem
For other people, for
for
relationships,
other,
I think you're
I think,
saying.
yeah, because it's, you know, it's a huge part of my evening, you know. It really is. And I resent this sort of, if you stop drinking, you know, like you need to stop drinking and your anxiety will be better. It's like, well, I'll be honest with you, I was sober for 7 years, no drink or drugs, and I was ill. You know, I was suicidal. I had no place in the world. I was lost. And I'm not saying that drink cured that at all. It absolutely didn't. But there is no, and by the same token, I know if I was able to get sober, my anxiety would definitely be reduced. But it is not gonna fix the emotional fucking scars that were caused when I was a kid. And if me having a few drinks of a night helps me write my music, that helps me process things, then I can live with that. But until I'm sort of ready enough to till I can picture a world where I don't drink, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm not sure if I'm trying to convince you or me here, because it's a tricky one.
I get what you're saying, man. You articulate that really beautifully, and it's very easy for people to just say, like, "Well, we'll just stop doing that then." It's all right. Well, I thought of that, dickhead. You know, like, of course, you know, everything is much more complicated. Everything is much
Well,
more
exactly. Yeah, it's
complicated.
weird. I told, speaking to my friend, I only started drinking it when I was about 30. That's when I discovered alcohol, you know. Well, I was a pothead. And my problem started way before I found drink. Fuck, I need to track, do with a bevy now, to be honest.
Oh, well, that was not my my
I'm
intention,
only
but
joking. No, I'm joking. It's too early for me.
yeah,
Those
I mean,
days are gone. I mean, those. It was when I was making Yekidar, it was bad. It was gin in the morning, bad. So I'm not there anymore. I think it's weird. That's how I sort of equate that. Both my parents drink every night. They're separated now, but that, you know, just grew up that people drink every fucking day. But when you're drinking early, that's when people are like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Hang on. But weirdly, like, neither of my parents want me to stop drinking. You know, I talk about it a lot with my friends. Fuck, I need to knock this on the head. But me mum and my dad, like, because if I've got a problem, they've got a problem. They're like, oh, Bill, you just like a drink. You just like your dad. You just like your mum. All right, you just like a drink. It's funny, like, everyone's got their own sort of reasons for you doing this or that, you know?
Yeah, very much so. Sometimes your actions like when you try and make changes for whatever reason, it's sometimes it holds a bit of a mirror up to other people, right? And like how they
I think
react to that is on them. Yeah,
that's happening right
it's on
now, I
their own.
think.
Yeah. Oh, there is a couple of things before I let you go, but there's a couple of things I wanted to touch on, and one of those things is hope, right? Because when I listen to the new record, it's that's what I took from it, right? As a hopeful record, and I don't want to do one of those really wanky things where I tell you what your record's about, but it's
That is the point, though. The point is that you are able to do that. So that's why I've, sorry, I know we'll let you finish because I have thought this whole thing. I think, what the record is about for me is fine. Oh, well and good. But I do write it in a way that people can have their own version. I'm not, it's not, this is just this is my record. You know what I mean? But you can have your record totally. Like, I have no issue. I actually, other people's versions of it are often just as interesting. Go on anyway.
Yeah, well, that's a beautiful thing, isn't it? When you're like watching live music, and you might have X amount of people there all singing, and it all means something, and they're all getting emotional, but for different reasons, right? It's yeah, I do think of it like that. I often find it very weird to speak to the person who made the music and say how I feel about it. But yeah, I suppose that's on me. But yeah, I got a lot of hope from it, and yeah, and I it seems like you're in a good place with it from listening to the record. And is hope, are you a hopeful person, Bill? Are you hopeful at the moment? Is that kind of like where, is
No,
that
I think I made the record because I needed hope in my life. Yawn, when we started playing Yawn live, very early on, I realized that the songs didn't make me happy. I wasn't enjoying playing my own songs, and that for me, I'm a bit dim and a little bit slow, but even I cottoned on that that's probably not the way for someone who's prone to depression and to spend their evenings, So I listen to beautiful music because it makes me happy and because it gives me hope. And I was working on the Mick Head record and I was doing a string arrangement and I was like, why the fuck am I not making music that's beautiful like this? This is what I love. This is what, why haven't I done that for years? So it was the central, that was the point. It was to give me something that I could go out. Well, it was firstly to something I could write that would make me happy writing it. Because writing beautiful music is a beautiful feeling. But then obviously, knowing that I can go out and play these songs live and I can mean these things. And it give me a positive sort of give me something positive to do with my talent was important.
Yeah.
Hope is I hope that'd be the one thing that we can all agree on from the record, Because you can't have kids singing on a record and it not be all, like if I managed to make that fucking, if I managed to ruin that, fucking load of depressed kids on a fucking record.
I mean that's absolutely stunning, those bits with the kids choirs, man. Yeah, real goosebumps stuff. And I wanted to ask as well about some of the music that of the bands that you're working with, man. So there's some incredible things coming out of your studio. I've been listening to little bits of Amelia Coburn. That's one of yours, right? And that's incredible songs, and Saint Saviour and all that stuff, man. It's
Both Teesiders,
right, okay, yeah.
from very near to each other, amazing songwriters. That helps, man. When you work with people, Saint Saviour in particular, I've said this countless times. I think she's the best songwriter I've ever worked with,
Wow.
and I include everyone ever. What she can do, and by that I mean how she makes her words fit her melodies, and the two never step on each other's toes, which for me is the craft. That's the thing I'm into the most. Saying something of interest, but not having it get in the way of the melody, but making them one thing, like the words and the melody sort of always belong together in some way. Like anyone can say the things that I say or Saint says, but to say them in with a melody that matches the feeling, that's when songs hit me, and I think she's the best at that, other than me, I must say.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've got Mick as well, Mick Head,
Oh,
I
mate. I mean, to be
mentioned.
honest, I could do a whole hour of a podcast just chatting about him, to be honest, mate. That I can't wait for his book when it comes later this year.
Oh,
So
fucking hell, yeah, well. Let's hope he's fucking finished it.
But yeah, incredible stuff, mate. I know you've got to jump on another call after this. I'm gonna let you
Right.
go. That flew by, but thank you so much for your time today,
That was a
Bill.
pleasure.
It's
Really enjoyed it.
oh mate, good. Thank you.
So do I stay on now?
A big up to the Proper Mental Podcast. The Proper Mental Podcast.